Hello, Vet Blast podcast listeners. Did you know that you can earn CE credits with this podcast? After listening to the episode, head on over to dvm360.com/flex and then sign in or register for a free account. Then select podcast and follow the online prompts to claim your CE.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. Well, you heard part one, but guess what? We're back for more with part two. We're going to be talking about a surgeon's perspective on current trends for the management of osteoarthritis, and this time specifically treatment options, sponsored by our friends at Elanco with the founder of OrthoVet Consulting, the one and only Dr. David Dykus. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. Well, we learned a lot about being proactive. We're going to chat a little bit further about that COAST approach as well. And in this podcast, we're going to chat a little bit more about canine osteoarthritis being more of a complex disease that impacts quality of life for many of our canine patients. And we're going to highlight why effective management requires development of a baseline treatment plan that is customized to the individual patient and includes a plan for managing flare-ups. A systematic evidence-based approach will be presented that can be implemented in general practice. A little bit of information about our friend, Dr. Dykus. He is frequently asked lecturer locally, nationally, and internationally. He's given over 200 continuing education lectures and taught over 125 laboratories. He has published numerous research articles and authored or co-authored several book chapters. He is the co-editor of the textbook Complications in Canine Cranial Cruciate Ligament Surgery. In 2023, Dr. Dykus received the Veterinary Hero Award right here at DVM 360 for Surgeon of the Year, and was named by DVM360.com as one of the 10 veterinarians to watch in 2018. And we're watching them. Dr. Dykus is a frequent contributor for updates in orthopedics to several veterinary websites and magazines. He's also been featured on SiriusXM's Doctor Radio segment on pet health and orthopedics. He's on the faculty for AO, and he is an orthopedic consultant for VIN. Along with being a scientific reviewer for multiple journals, he serves on the editorial review board and is the associate editor for Orthopedics for Veterinary Surgery, the official publication of the American and European Colleges of Veterinary Surgeons. Dr. Dykus became a certified canine rehabilitation practitioner through the University of Tennessee in 2015. He is the founder and orthopedic surgeon at Fusion Veterinary Orthopedics, where he has focus on total joint replacement, complex and minimally invasive fracture repair, as well as angular limb deformity correction, 3D implant printing, and arthroscopy. He is the founder of OrthoVet Consulting, an educational consulting and orthopedic coaching service. You know, I love that we're chatting a lot, by the way, about 3D printing. I think that's fantastic. You must love it.
It is a lot of fun. I know just enough to get myself in trouble if I try to do it myself, but thankfully, I have great colleagues that can assist in some of the technical aspects I don't fully get. I know what I want, like in my head, I can visualize what I want, but getting the computer to do what I want and creating the file to print it sometimes is challenging. But it's a phenomenal piece of the future that's coming about that I think is really going to change a lot of our approaches to orthopedics and improving our precision and accuracy of things. It's a great tool to have.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Really looking forward to seeing more of that. Okay, so let's chat a little bit further about treatment of osteoarthritis. So from your perspective as an orthopedic surgeon, what do you see as the top challenges for general practitioners when it comes to managing canine OA?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is figuring where in the course of the disease a patient is, because we can have a patient with osteoarthritis, but it's a spectrum of a disease and they can be at different points along that spectrum. And so for me, traditionally, what I like to do is break it into two categories. I wanted to ask myself, do I have a patient that could develop arthritic changes? So the best example here would be a dog with a torn cruciate ligament. It doesn't matter what acronym of surgery I do, that dog's going to develop arthritic changes. Or do I have a dog that I used to call incidental OA, meaning a dog that comes in for vomiting, and you take abdominal radiographs to rule out a foreign body and the hips look really bad. But the owners have never mentioned that to you. So we sometimes also call that radiographic OA. Or do I have a patient that is a preclinical OA patient, meaning I've decided to use the canine osteoarthritis staging tool or the COAST tool, and they have a COAST grade one. So one of these three categories would then go into the, these patients are not in a flare up at the moment, but we don't want to ignore it. So we're going to establish our baseline management, which we can talk about. Versus, do I have a patient that's in a flare up? And so this would be a patient that not only has radiographic evidence of osteoarthritis, but they have clinical joint pain. And in this situation, we have to switch gears from our baseline management to a focus on getting pain under control and taking a multimodal approach. If we try to take a patient in a flare-up and manage them like we would a patient not in a flare-up, we're not going to be very successful. So understanding where in the course of the disease they are is very, very important. But then also keeping the fact that our approach needs to be patient-specific. It can't be a cookbook approach. And regardless of whether they're in a flare-up or not in a flare-up, our number one strategy of what we're doing needs to be eliminating, minimizing, or modulating inflammation. Because, you know, OA in and of itself might not be a primary inflammatory disease, but it is a very, very inflammatory disease. And by getting that under control and keeping it in check, I think we can certainly improve our abilities to make our patients' quality of lives better.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I want to chat more about the COAST approach. I mean, I've sat in a couple of your lectures around the country, and you're so wonderful in educating the learners about that. So to the listeners, discuss the recently published treatment guidelines by the COAST SAGE, and what are the key takeaways that they should know?
Yeah. So, you know, in part one, when you and I had a discussion on diagnosis, we talked a little bit about what the COAST tool is and how it can be incorporated. But now we can take that grade that we get from it, and we can then apply what we might use management-wise. And what I found is of those two groups that I just explained to you, those that aren't in a flare-up, that would usually correspond to a COAST grade 0 to 1 versus patients that are in a flare-up, which would then become a COAST grade 2 to 4. So if we look at consensus guidelines that have come out for the COAST grade 0 or 1, client education is key. They need to know that management is going to be stepwise. They need to know that the disease is progressive, and they need to know that flare-ups are going to happen. But we have to establish that daily baseline management, which consists of weight control. And if they are an overweight dog, we need to work on getting weight off of them at 10% increments until we get the body condition that we want. And the way to get weight control is not only through diet, but also daily exercise. And we have to be very specific with owners as to what daily exercise is, because daily playtime is opening the back door and the dog takes off running the fence line. The worst thing that dogs can do to their joints is speed up, slow down, and twist and turn. And what do dogs love to do? Speed up, slow down, and twist and turn. And so that is playtime, but that's not daily exercise. And in fact, things like that, we need to think about limiting how long and how often we do them, and then move towards daily exercise, which is daily walking. I mean, that is the best form of exercise, is leash walking. And so it does require a little bit of effort on the owner's part, meaning they need to be able to commit. Ideally, I would like 20 to 30 minutes twice a day on level flat ground. I don't think that 40 minutes to 60 minutes with your dog is a lot to ask, especially if we want to be as aggressive as we can to try to slow down and minimize progression. But we also have to think about lifestyle activities. So, you know, if we have a long-haired dog, perhaps we trim the hair so it's not growing over and they're sliding on the paw pads. If there's a lot of slippery floors, we think about yoga mats or rugs. If there's stairs, we think about limiting stair usage or using carpet runners. We think about trying to minimize high concussive activities and circle in other less concussive activities that the dog can still use to be active. And then we can also bring in our joint supplements and our omega-3 fatty acids. I think omega-3 omega-3 fatty acids are critical in terms of helping modulate inflammation. And usually I would be shooting for 150 to 175 mgs per kg of DHA and EPA daily. And then our joint supplements can also be helpful, but I'm more of a fan of what is in the supplement that's going to be combating inflammation. And so there are a number of things out there that we have to make sure we do our due diligence and research on in terms of what particular supplement we're recommending. And then our polysulfated glycos, aminoglycans, where we can inject underneath the skin or into the muscle. So that would be Adequan. I'm a fan of using Adequan twice a week for 4 weeks when I diagnose OA. I don't give it every month. I don't think there's a good benefit to that per se. But if they have a flare up, we'll do it twice a week for 4 weeks. Or if they have OA that we are aware of, then I might do it every 4 months or every 6 months, just depending. But if we have a patient that goes into a flare up, so they actually now have clinical signs of OA and they have joint pain, or they're progressing in the disease and now the COAST score is a bit higher. So these are the 2 to 4. Traditionally, where we're going to start is getting inflammation under control. And that's going to be with our nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. That's going to be our first line. Understanding that over time, as they progress to a COAST grade 3 or 4, we might have to add in other oral medications such as amantadine or pregabalin, or we could even consider gabapentin, understanding that we need to make sure the dosage is high enough. That's probably more than 10 mgs per kg, and it really needs to be given 3 times a day. And so that makes it a compliance problem. And so that's where pregabalin might come into play, because pregabalin can be given twice a day. You know, is gabapentin effective at controlling joint pain twice a day? I don't know. What I would tell people to stop doing is, for pain management, to stop giving it once a day and stop giving it as needed. And the other problem is we really have no clinical evidence that gabapentin is effective at controlling joint pain. We do know that amantadine has clinical evidence that it's effective at controlling joint pain. But then there's other things that we can add in patients that have a flare-up. We can inject things into the joint to try to calm down the inflammatory response. I'm a huge proponent of formalized physical rehabilitation, because during a flare-up, we can't exercise them because they're painful. So we can't expect the owner to take them on a walk, but we also don't want to lose range of motion and muscle strength, because that's critical to limb function. So we can put them into a formalized rehabilitation program to maintain active muscle engagement and not lose range of motion or lose muscle mass, and also facilitate pain control to get them through that flare-up. And then we've also got kind of last ditch effort options when we're, you know, further advanced in the course of the disease. And that's where maybe an injection of a anti-nerve growth monoclonal antibody might come into play, or even surgical intervention where we might fuse a joint, remove a joint, or replace a joint.
Okay, my pen ran out of ink. That's how much I'm writing here, Dr. Dykus, from this. So this is fantastic. Pregabalin, gab. I'm writing it all down. This is wonderful. All right. So you touched a little bit on NSAIDs. And I do think that me being the GP and many of you listening, and that's probably what you go to. But we do have some hesitation about that, right? So, you know, what would you say to vets who are hesitant to use NSAIDs longer term due to concerns about toxicity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, here's what I'll say. If I have a patient with a flare up, I'm typically going to prescribe the NSAID for roughly 3 to 4 months. And that usually is like a mind blower to most people. And the reason for that is, number one, really nothing in my orthopedic world heals in 2 weeks except for the skin incision I make. So if we're treating an OA flare up, if we're treating a fracture, if we're treating a tendinopathy, those things aren't going to go away in 2 weeks. You know, I think what tends to happen is when an owner sees that there's a mobility issue, the patient's at the peak of a flare up, and we put them on an NSAID and they get better, so they sort of start to bottom out. But the problem is if we pull the NSAID away too early, they're just going to start right back up that escalation until they hit a point again, and then we re-prescribe the NSAID. And we're assuming that the peaks and troughs will stay exactly the same. But the problem is with the maladaptive pain response, is that the brain will start to perceive the same stimulus as more painful over time. So really those peaks are getting higher and those troughs aren't going as low. And so coming in to combat inflammation and get it under control for a longer term, I think is beneficial because a lot of these patients have been in flare-ups for weeks, if not months, by the time they get to us. And so it takes some time to get them out of that. But then that starts to, you know, make a lot of people uncomfortable because of adverse side effects. And so we then have to say, well, if we're going to use something for a longer duration, is it going to be more effective than using it for a shorter duration? And is it going to be as safe? And there was a review paper that came out in 2010 that looked at exactly this. And what they found is that in patients with OA, those treated with an NSAIDs longer, meaning greater than 14 days, had better outcomes. But also they looked at the adverse event reporting and found that patients that were on an NSAID longer, the adverse event reporting was so low, it was likely due to the individual dog, not the actual drug class itself. So the data does support that longer-term usage has a better effect, and it does not support that doing that causes an increase in adverse events. I just think for some reason we've been, you know, it's been put into our heads that NSAIDs are loaded with adverse effects. We should use them for a very short period of time. And I don't think that that's correct because that is the gold standard pain reliever that we have in dogs with OA. In study after study after study, it's tried and true that NSAIDs are going to be the most effective at controlling joint pain.
What is it about Galliprant specifically then? Because the mechanism of action is a little bit different than some other non-steroidals out there, right?
That's correct. The mechanism of action is different because it's a receptor-specific anti-inflammatory in that it's targeting the EP4 receptor, which in the joint is a receptor known to kick out a number of inflammatory mediators. The advantage, though, is it's not blocking some of the other receptors that we can sometimes be related with adverse events, such as decreasing renal blood flow or GI blood flow. And so it makes the margin of safety much, much higher. If you ever take the box and you pull out that big white piece of paper, and then you're like, it has all these words on it, and the font's so small, I have no idea what it says. But if you get a magnifying glass and you look at it, the margin of safety is so high with Galliprant. So I don't have an issue at all using it long term. But the other thing that's important to think about is when you look at the efficacy, it actually continues becoming more effective the longer they're on it. So there is a difference between patients who are on Galliprant and a placebo at day 14. At day 28, that trajectory kept going up in the Galliprant group, but the delta, so the difference between the treatment and the placebo, was actually getting wider the longer out it went. And so what that shows to me is that it becomes more effective over time, and it's probably even doing a better job clinically than what we maybe give it credit for.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Really interesting. Okay. And, you know, as we wrap up, last question, there is a lot of excitement about Librela, anti-nerve growth factor monoclonal antibody. And how does it work, and when should it be used?
Absolutely. I think it's another tool to our tool belt that we can add in that has its place. It is a very effective pain reliever, but it's not going to do anything in terms of acting as an anti-inflammatory. And remember, we said that our number one strategy needs to be at minimizing, modulating, or eliminating inflammation. And so Librela is going to do an excellent job of getting pain under control. So for me personally, where I think I would utilize it is going to be in those patients where we are already on our daily NSAIDs. Perhaps we've been on again, off again of amantadine. We've tried joint injections. It's failed. We've tried formal rehab therapy, and the flare-ups are becoming more frequent, or we just can't get this one under control, and we need something to help with some of the breakthrough pain, then what I would do is I would give a dose of Librela. I would stop my NSAID about 2 weeks later, and then I would give one to two more doses of Librela and then pull them off of it and then put them back on the anti-inflammatory. So the way I look at it is as I use it to break a flare up in the latter course of the disease. So COAST grade 3, grade 4 scenario. I would use extreme caution in giving it to a patient with any sort of neurologic or neuromuscular disease. So, you know, dogs with laryngeal paralysis, dogs with wobblers, dogs with IVD, dogs with degenerative myelopathy, LS disease. I would be very cautious in those patients.
Great. Excellent. Dr. Dyke, as you packed in this session, my friend, this was fantastic. Absolutely helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm glad that you found it helpful, and hopefully listeners will as well.
Yeah, no, I know they will. I took lots of notes here. So thank you so much for joining us. Again, thank you to our friends at Elanco for supporting this great education. Don't forget to rate this podcast as we continue to grow and support the channel. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay possum.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to claim your CE credit for listening to this podcast via dvm360.com/flex, where you can register or log in to your free account. Then select Podcast CE and follow the online prompts. We hope you enjoyed the episode. See you next time, and remember, always stay possum.